Book of 2 John, and today we're going to look at verses 9 through 13, so hopefully we're going to finish the book. Last week, the key thing that I wanted to get across was at the very end, and that was in verse 8. And in verse 8 it says, "Watch yourselves, that you may not lose what we have accomplished, but that you may receive a full reward." But most of the manuscripts actually read a little differently. They say, "Watch yourselves," talking to a congregation, a local church, "you watch yourselves, that we," that is John and the other apostles that helped found that church, "might not lose what they had accomplished." And so there's a connection between those who initiated the church and those who are now carrying on its ministry. If those who are now carrying on the ministry fall into this false doctrine of Jesus Christ, then there's going to be reward, then the apostles are not going to get the full reward, because that church will not have come to fruition. And the capacity that it had to spread doctrine to many people's lives, proper doctrine, will have been stunted because of a false doctrine of Christ. And it doesn't mean that John and the apostles are going to lose rewards. It doesn't mean that. Notice it says that they will not receive full reward. They're going to get reward for everything that they did in initiating that church. But all that it could have become is stunted. And that somehow is related to the doctrine of full rewards. But just because a church goes apostate after you leave does not mean that you, because you were solid, lose reward. It just means that the reward did not grow as much as it could have grown. That church obviously has kind of fallen by the wayside. And many churches we know, particularly from Revelation chapter 2 and 3, I don't think any of those churches exist today. And if you read Revelation 2 and 3, what do you find? You know, if you do not heed my words, then I'll remove your lampstand. I'll remove your church. And so we find that those seven churches are totally gone. Apparently they did not, over time, heed to the commands that were given, the exhortation that was given in those seven short letters in Revelation 2 and 3, and therefore the lampstand was taken away. But today we're going to look at verses 9 through 13, remaining in the doctrine of Christ. And verses 12 and 13 are a farewell from John to his readers. Now, let's look at verses 9 through 13. Let's read. "Anyone who goes too far and does not abide in the teaching of Christ does not have God. The one who abides in the teaching, he has both the Father and the Son. If anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, do not receive him into your house, and do not give him a greeting. For the one who gives him a greeting participates in his evil deeds. Now, having many things to write to you, I do not want to do so with paper and ink, but I hope to come to speak to you and speak face to face, that your joy may be made full. The children of your chosen sister greet you." Now, in verse 9, he begins with a short phrase, "anyone who goes too far." Now, that is in the critical text, but that's the word parago. And there's a manuscript difference here in this first word. I don't really think, there's only four manuscripts that I know of that actually have this reading of parago. The one that's most common you find is parabino, and it means to go aside. And the King James translates it, for example, to transgress it, if you have the King James. To transgress, to go aside from and not abide in the teaching or the doctrine of Christ. So, this isn't saying one goes too far in his study of the doctrine of Christ. It's saying that he goes aside from the teaching of the doctrine of Christ. But the New American Standard does not reflect that, and so you need to see a difference between that, going aside and going too far. This warning does not mean that someone can lose his salvation. Number one, anyone who goes too far and does not abide in the teaching of Christ does not have God. In other words, if someone departed from the teaching about Christ, does that mean they lose their salvation? Well, this says they do not have God. But this verse is not teaching that they lose their salvation. The second thing it's not teaching that someone was never saved, that they never had God. It's not teaching that either. What it does show is that a Christian can turn aside or go aside from true doctrine and go into heresy, even when the heresy has something to do with Christ. Remember, the context here is basically Christology, a proper doctrine of Christ, because verse 7 said that some come teaching that Jesus Christ has not come in the flesh. So the doctrine that Paul or John is wanting to affirm and keep very accurate is the doctrine of Christ or Christology. Not what Christ has taught, not the things that he taught necessarily, but who and what he is. And that's what the challenge has been from these deceivers. The immediate context indicates here that if a Christian does turn aside from true doctrine, that he will fail to receive full reward, as verse 8 told us. Too many theologians will make a very serious error in verses like this, and the way they do it is they pull it out of context and then say that this verse teaches loss of salvation or that these people were never really saved. But these Bible teachers are falling for the fallacy that these texts are talking about eternal salvation. Verse 9 is not talking about eternal salvation. This type of approach abuses several books in the New Testament. And I'm going to list several books and or chapters of the Bible that are seriously thwarted because of teachers who will teach like texts like this are about eternal salvation. 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John have been radically distorted throughout church history. The book of Hebrews has been radically distorted throughout history, and Revelation chapter 2 and 3 have been pretty thwarted throughout history. All these books or chapters are written to true believers. Okay? They are not written to professing unbelievers. That is, a professing unbeliever is someone who professes Christ, but they're not really a believer. A lot of people say these books are written to those people. I beg to differ substantially with that analysis. These books are written to believers, but they're written to believers warning them that they're going to lose rewards. Not that they're going to lose salvation, and not that they're not really saved, but that these believers, if they don't continue on in true doctrine, are going to lose reward. They're going to be disciplined. So, look at this context. Remember in verse 8, what's it talking about? Rewards. Who are rewards for? Are they for unbelievers? Are they even in the realm where they even possibly get rewards? No. The context here is about believers. And only Christians can lose rewards. So theologians who teach that this book and these others that I've mentioned are about salvation instead of sanctification are radically misunderstanding these books. And the result is a loss of 22 chapters of scriptural teaching if you take that approach. And you're forced to. If you take 1 John to be written to people who are not really believers, but they profess Christ, then you're forced to take 2 John, 3 John, Hebrews, and Revelation 2 and 3 the same way, if you're consistent. And but John here doesn't want us to lose 22 chapters of Scripture. He wants us to interpret in the context. And John doesn't want Christians to go aside from and not abide in the doctrine of Christ. The phrase doctrine of Christ does not mean the doctrine given by Christ in His earthly teachings, but it means the doctrine about Christ, who and what Jesus Christ is, His nature and His person. And John's subject is Christological heresies that distort the person of Christ. Serious loss of rewards take place when Christians don't have a proper doctrine of Jesus Christ. Such a Christian does not have God. Now, what does it mean that he does not have God? Oh, wait, maybe I'm not ready for that. I'm not ready for that yet. Since he did not remain in the doctrine of Christ, but went aside from it, he leaves God behind. Okay? God is not with him in his abandonment of the proper doctrine of Christ. This does not mean he's unsaved. If a person really did believe the truth at some point in time, let's say you truly did believe, but then you abandon the truth about Christ, you come up with some kind of heresy about who he was, then that person, does that mean he's lost? He loses his salvation or that he never was a believer? No. A true believer can leave the doctrine of Christ. That person, if he really exercises faith, is still born of God. Contrary to the opinions of some theologians, we are not saved by continuing to believe, but by believing. Okay? This is a very important point. This is coming up a lot now. And many of the things I'm reading, that we're being taught now by many theologians that we have to continue to believe if we're going to be really believers. It's not a one-time belief at a point in time, but a belief that goes on and on. And so they're taking John 3:16 this way. Some have recently taken John 3:16 to mean continual belief, so that it would read like this: For God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, that whoever continually believes in Him shall not perish but have eternal life. But this makes havoc of the present tense. Now it is true that a present tense, which is believe in that context, can have an ongoing nuance. But suffice it to say that there is nowhere in the New Testament is ongoing faith made a condition of eternal life. How could it be, for example, that salvation is conditioned on continual faith when the miracles of regeneration and doctrine and justification take place in an instant? How could that be? How can one be continual and yet we receive eternal life and are regenerated at an instant in time? See, so realizing this vexing problem of continual belief doesn't fit with the miracles of regeneration and justification, theologians try to get around this by saying this: that you are really saved at the moment you exercise true saving faith. But we can't know whether we really believed or not unless we remain in the faith. In other words, never go into any kind of heresy and never get into any kind of bad sin pattern. And so all this means is that we're supposed to accept this absurd idea that we can believe without knowing that we have really believed or not. So you see what they're doing? They're inloading the gospel. You have the gospel. It comes to you and it says you must believe in Jesus Christ. And that's what that's all you have to do. Just believe. And they're saying, no, if you don't have good works that follow, or you don't continue in that faith, then you didn't ever really exercise true saving faith. And so what they're doing is they're inloading the gospel, tacking on sanctification works to the gospel. And that's an addition to the gospel that we want to keep away from the gospel. That's not the gospel, as Paul would tell us. Now, some argue that John is so clear in this verse. He says, look, they don't have God. I mean, it says they do not have God. For example, one theologian says, this phrase means that he does not possess God in a saving relationship. See, they pulled it right out of the context. What's the context? The context is rewards and of abiding, which are restricted to Christians. Notice how many times in verse 9 he uses the word abide. He uses it twice. Now, abiding is a term that means to remain. I'm going to give you an example of what it means to remain. If I call you and I say, I want you to stay at HEB until I get there. I want you to remain at HEB until I get there. Now, that statement only makes sense if you're already there. See? Remain there. Stay. Don't leave. I'll be there in 10 minutes. That doesn't make any sense if you're not really there. Now, John uses abide the same way. If these people had never been abiding, then how could they... If they'd never been, how could they be abiding if they never had been there? See, these people are clearly believers, and he's saying they're not abiding in the teaching of Christ. He didn't say they abandoned. He didn't say they're not believers. He clearly didn't say that. He used the word abide to describe these individuals. So when he says they're not abiding in the doctrine of Christ, they first had to be there for them to abandon it. Christians may not be abiding. Instead, they may go aside from the doctrine of Christ. On the flip side, what about the last part of the verse? It says, what about the one who is abiding in the teaching? He has both the Father and the Son. This one has both the Father and the Son, meaning he's vitally in touch with God. He's vitally in touch with God. These people are adhering to the doctrine of Christ and therefore living Christ. How could you live Christ if you departed from His gospel, see? Or if he departed from who and what he was. You couldn't live him. See? So ultimately, these people who are abiding in the teaching of Christ are storing up full reward. So we have those who have transgressed or went aside from the doctrine of Christ. So let's say that this is the doctrine of Christ. And doctrine of Christ. And then here we have those that are abiding in that doctrine of Christ. Now, we have others that at one time were believers and believed this truth, and now they're going aside from it. They're leaving the doctrine of Christ. These are the ones that do not have God in their thinking. God is not with them in this attempt to leave the doctrine of Christ. That's what John is saying in this verse. Now, what about when a believer moves away from the teaching of Christ? We find that God would not be with him. God only approves of our actions when they line up with His Word. And on the other side of the coin, the one who does abide in His Word, God is with him. He is approving of the course that you are taking as you study His Word. And this, if you abide in this, this results in two things: discipleship and growth in the Christian life. So this is a warning against doctrinal deviation and its consequent disobedience in the area of Christology. And we're going to look at the doctrine of Christ next week, because I've got one more week, and what else am I going to do? So, these at the home church of the elect lady should not be led astray by the false doctrine of Christ. Instead, they should abide in the proper doctrine of Christ, which will result in full reward. Now, verse 10. If anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, do not receive him into your house and do not give him a greeting. Now, if is a particle of fulfilled condition. This means that it was already taken place. People were already coming in and trying to bring that teaching to this church of the elect lady and the children. Now, remember the story about the elect lady and the children? John was apparently out and he met these children somewhere, and they sat down and had lunch. He had enough time to observe their behavior wherever they might have been to see that they were walking in the commandments of Christ. But they sat down and had lunch one day, and apparently they relayed some problems or issues going on in their local church. And this is how we know that this is a part of, this is how this fits with this particle of fulfilled condition. How did John know this was already going on in the church? Because the children of the elect lady told him this was going on in the church. Now, it was a common phenomenon in the Greco-Roman world of John's day to have the familiar figure of the traveling teacher or philosopher, who would go from town to town making his living by going from place to place, recruiting students who would pay for his instruction. The Christian church also had its traveling teachers, in particular what we call the evangelists. And as 3 John shows, these men likewise needed to be supported financially if they were to carry on their work of evangelization. What John now enjoined on the members of the church here in 2 John was a determination to refuse all help for any professed Christian teacher who did not proclaim the truth about Jesus Christ. Now, it's clear that these are teachers, okay, first of all, because they don't bring the teaching. They're teachers that are coming to this church, and they want to bring their teaching about Christ. And so these are not just regular people that are coming by and saying, I need assistance and help for lodging or food. But these are teachers. These traveling teachers often received assistance by way of two things, primarily food and lodging. They need a place to stay, and they need something to eat. So John is telling this lady and her children not to provide food or lodging for them, or even, what does it say, to give them a greeting. Now, John instructs local churches to respond to revealed or known false teachers in two ways. First, no lodging and food. Second, no, and you'll see in a minute that this is not a greeting as someone comes to the door, but it's a greeting that you would give when someone leaves, a departure greeting. This means, in the least, do not provide lodging and food. But the wisdom of not allowing such people even to get in the door has often been proved by those who have invited the representatives of cults to come in and talk. Letting them in is often easier than getting them out, as you all well know. Moreover, we put our wives and children at risk whenever we let deceptive spirits into our homes. And that's a significant thing, I believe. And or churches. So we are commanded to bar false teachers from entry, and they are to be barred from teaching from a pulpit if at a church. The second thing is we're not to give him a greeting. And the English word greet does not do justice to the Greek intent. We think of a greeting as, hey, hello, how are you doing? You know, as you meet someone. But that's not what John is talking about. John is talking about the moment when someone departs. The word kairo for greet means to rejoice, to be glad. It was a standardized equivalent of John's day of these sayings in our modern day. Good day, goodbye, good luck. As you send someone on your way, you say these general terms. So why would John be so intent that we not even use these standard words of departure, such as goodbye? Well, John gives us the reason in verse 11. He says, "For the one who gives him a greeting participates in his evil deeds." Now, I'm going to be quite honest with you here. Many commentators are offended by John's intolerance here. Many Christian commentators are offended by John's intolerance here in verse 11. They perceive this to be a harsh and excessive teaching. Why is saying good day, good luck, or goodbye so wrong? Because to say goodbye or good day to him is to participate in his evil deeds. John doesn't take language lightly. There is no doubt that we often say things that are routine things. We're just going through the motions. For example, what's up? How's it going? What are you up to? And you know what? We don't really want to know what's up. We don't really care how it's going. We could give a hoot what they're up to. See? And these are just surface routine sayings, but John does not share this type of insincere, superficial view of greetings. He takes language seriously. And if a Christian is personally resistant to the common hypocrisies of the society around him, then he should cultivate sincerity and genuineness in what he says. This affects how we greet people. The Greek word for participate is koinonia. It's the same word for fellowship. In this context, it means to become a partner with these evil teachers, to become a partaker in their evil deeds. You partner up with them when you give them the greeting goodbye, or good luck, or good day. We then become the propagators of false heresy, false teaching. From God's perspective, to partner with a known false teacher is to be as guilty as the known offender. Let's think of this for a moment. Would you really want to say, "Have a good day," to a man I knew to be an enemy of the truth? Suppose he did have a good day. Would that not be a bad day for the truth? Makes a lot of sense. So as for further application of this teaching, it applies to Christian giving. More directly so in the book of 3 John. But there is an application of this to 2 John. It is the responsibility of every believer to give, first of all. Secondly, it's his responsibility to know exactly where his financial gift is going if you give to some ministry. And for years and years, believers, particularly in the 20th century, have unknowingly given to specific so-called Christian institutions that are funding liberal unbelief. Groups that laugh at Jesus and the Bible. And all along, these believers think that their money is going to promote Christianity. But actually, it's being used to promote anti-Christianity. And by doing so, they are propagating false doctrine unknowingly and are partners with the deceiver and the Antichrist. Most Christians have no idea what is going on in their denomination, and this is very common. I can't even express the magnitude of Christian giving that has gone to apostate organizations. Organizations that, as I said, laugh at Jesus in the Bible, saying that he was a good teacher, that he got married, that he was a homosexual, or 100 other different things. And these organizations sit under what most of us consider good denominational names. And I really feel sorry for many Christians who have given so much of their time and money to these organizations and have actually fueled opponents to Christianity. And I'm talking about billions and billions of dollars, not hundreds of dollars or thousands of dollars. And this is one reason that I personally am against hierarchical church organizations. And that's why I believe in a local, independent church such as this one. Independent. In other words, we're not connected to any other organizations. No hierarchy behind this structure that we have here. And we get to say where our money goes. Okay? And we don't have to send it up some chain where people we don't even know can dispense the funds however they wish, to whomever they wish, whenever they wish. But many believers are going to be surprised at the judgment seat of Christ when they find out that because of their irresponsibility with giving, and they didn't check out where it was going, that all of a sudden this affects their rewards. See, well, it is our responsibility as individuals to investigate and find out where our money is going when we give it to an organization. And because you may be partnering with evildoers. And with the internet today, you have a great outlet to be able to search these things, something that can really help you if you do give to some ministry like that. But I can tell you, you don't have to do any research here because I did it for you. I can tell you that this local church is not a partner with any organization or hierarchy. We're an independent Bible church, and if you give to this church, then your money goes into the operating fund of this church and furthers the dissemination of doctrine taught at this church. If you designate your gift to a specific ministry, for example, audio ministry, then we keep tabs on how much money has been given to that account. And if we have need or maintenance items in that area, then we use your designated gift to fund that ministry. My point is here that you don't have to worry about your money going through this ministry to any place that you wouldn't want it to go and fund false teaching and therefore endangering your rewards. Verse 12. Having many things to write to you, I do not want to do so with paper and ink, but I hope to come to you and speak face to face that your joy may be full. The children of your chosen sister greet you. John has much more apparently to say to the elect lady, the chosen lady. But he's going to wait until he can speak to her in person. He says, notice in verse 12, I do not want to do so. The word want is bulamai. And it's the same word we looked at in Ephesians 1:11 when it says that God, according to the counsel of His will, the counsel, and that word counsel was bule, and it meant that He deliberated before He came up with the plan that He wanted to put into history. He deliberated about it. He thought about it. He considered it. And then he came. You think God considered all this? Yeah, God deliberated. He didn't just do it. But He knows everything. But He still deliberated. And then he came to a certain conclusion about the plan he was going to put into act. Notice here that John says, I do not want bulamai. So in other words, John thought about this very seriously. He deliberated about whether he was going to write her more or stop the letter now. And his deliberation came to the conclusion that I'm not going to write anymore. I've said what I need to say, and I'll talk to her in face-to-face at a later point in time. So, it's not that John doesn't have more time to write. He could continue writing. But he says, I've thought through this, and I think it's wise if I wait to talk to this lady. Now, why? Why would he want to wait? This, first of all, this speaks volumes about the importance of this letter, even though it's very short. Because John chose not to wait to visit her to tell her the things he did tell her in the letter. He chose to write her immediately about certain things. Okay, and that had to do with false teaching. So John had a very high priority of false teachers and the bad influence and the bad repercussions that can take place if false teachers get in the church. So he wrote that part immediately, but why didn't he write all that was on his mind? Weiss postulates, the many things which he had in mind were hard things, like his warning against the intercourse with heretics. And he would not write at a distance, but would wait till he was on the spot and had personal knowledge. It is easy to lay down general principles, but this application to particular cases is a delicate task, demanding knowledge, sympathy, charity. Number one, the sight of people's faces appeals to one's heart and softens one's speech. Just having a Bible teaching that is one-on-one, face-to-face, rather than via tape ministry, for example, which ministers, but still, this softens one's speech when this is the medium. Secondly, when one meets with people and talks with them, one's judgment of them and their options is often modified. In other words, you can only do so much via email or a forum discussion because you're not hearing their voice. They can't fill you in on all the details, and you can't tell them, "Hey, I don't understand you here." You can't interject in those types of mediums, but face to face, you can interject and say, "Could you back up? I don't understand that," or "What do you mean by this?" And so, a modern application, of course, concerns the use of email, forum discussions, or telephone discussions. Such mediums can often be rigorous and helpful halls of debate in helping us understand and learn about God Yet the impersonal nature, not seeing their face, often leads to judging too fast or to dialoguing in a manner that does not befit the Christian. We need to be extra careful in our choice of words when dialoguing via such mediums, lest we forget that the other individual is a brother in Christ. If we see a Christian face to face, then the natural thing to do is to soften our tone. A lot of times, even here from the pulpit, I'm a lot harder than I would be if I was just talking to you one-on-one. Many of you probably know that. Perhaps after a personal discussion with an individual, a better analysis of the situation can be gleaned, and individuals can be loosed of all charges. Thus, in this case, John thought it best not to write the many things that he had on his mind. John thought it best not to write them all, but by paper and ink. Now, two interesting words. Paper refers to cartu, and it was made from the pith of a triangular stalk. So this plant had a stalk that went up, and it was triangular in shape, and in the center was a pith. And they would take the pith out in the ancient world, and they'd lay these piths out in strips side by side. And then they'd take more strips, and they'd lay them this way. And then they'd take a paste, a glue, and they would put some of that on there and maybe do another layer. And then they would take a heavy object and they would lay it on top of it, and that's how they made paper. And secondly, he talks about the ink. The ink comes from the word melanos, from which we get the word melanin, which is the pigment in your skin, melanin. In the ancient world, it meant a deep or dark pigmentation, but later it came to be the reference for the word ink. And in this case, because we know there were other colors of ink, such as red and gold in the ancient world, what we can tell about this letter is that John wrote it in his own hand, he wrote it in black ink, and he wrote it on this type of paper. So John wrote this little letter of 13 verses on this cartoon paper of black ink. However brief this letter, it contributes greatly to our understanding of one thing, or several things. But number one, in this verse, we realize that it's important that we deal with false teachers. The very fact that John addressed false teaching in the letter indicates that he placed a high priority on protecting Christians from error. Pastors who do not warn the flock against false teachers or teachings are extremely derelict. They really are. They allow the wolves to attack the Lord's sheep. In fact, a pastor who does not warn the Lord's sheep of false doctrines and teachers does not love the Lord or his sheep. That is what Jesus said to Peter. Do you love me? If you love me, do what to my sheep? Feed my sheep. You've got to give them the truth and continually to warn off the wolves, see? Otherwise, you're not loving the Lord. And otherwise, you're not loving the sheep that are the Lord's. So this is a very critical book, a very helpful book for how to deal with false teachers. But rather than continuing the letter for the aforementioned reasons, John hopes to come and speak face to face, verse 12 tells us, with the lady and her children. Literally, it's stoma to stoma. And the stoma is the mouth. Okay? He wants to speak mouth to mouth with them and have a dialogue right there in their presence. John is certain that when they do see one another face to face, it's going to be a time of mutual joy, both his and theirs. And finally, verse 13, the children of your chosen sister greet you. John closes out the letter by relaying a greeting from the lady's nephews and nieces, which must have been in the company of the lady's children when they came into contact with John. And this lady's sister was also one of the elect, one of the chosen ones, who was either not there and did not meet John, so she couldn't greet him, or she had already passed on to be with the Lord. So that's the short but what I consider a potent epistle, 2 John. Because 1 John gives us truth, or it gives us love. It tells us about loving one another. But 2 John gives us the boundaries for those truths and the importance of avoiding Christological heresies. And we're going to look at some of these doctrines next week. But I'm done. So are there any questions? Fred?
I have a question. I guess I'm more Mormon comes to your door and he wants to speak to you and he asks for a drink of water, do I just send him on the west?
Well, here's kind of, there are several things you can do. Probably they're not going to come ask for a drink of water, but you're asking about. Okay. Oh, well, okay. We've got to deal with this. There's two things that I kind of, you know, you're thinking, if you're thinking along the lines of Matthew 25, you know, those who gave him a drink of water, you know, and all that. Of course, that's in the context of Israel, but I think you could probably make an application there. Most of the time, I wouldn't let him in. If that's a way of trying to get in the door, I wouldn't let him in. These people, they want to meet with you. They want to talk about spiritual things. If you're ready for an apologetic discussion, get them a drink of water and sit on the porch and have that. And you can defend Christianity right there if you're ready to go. If not, I can guarantee you, if you'll make an appointment with them to meet at some other place, away from the home in a public place, they will meet with you. And there you can set up a meeting to go and discuss these spiritual issues with them. That will give you time to reflect, to pray, and to get ready to defend Christianity over against whatever false teaching they're going to bring to you. And that's probably what most believers want to do, because we're usually not ready to deal with something like that when it comes confronts us at our doorstep. So that's what I would do. You could sit on the front porch and have your discussion there, or you could go to another location at another designated time. Well, I said, yeah, you could have water on the front porch.
Then give them the water of the word and they'll be sick. If you give them the gospel, they'll be sick.
Well, I've always done is I just ask them if they're going to heaven. And then that kind of shakes my faith. What I believe is I know I'm going to heaven. And then I'm fast.
They're terribly evangelistic because they're thinking that they're all work systems. And so, I mean, this is almost like a requirement for them to get to heaven. So they're all like, they don't know, you know, or where they're going to be if it's a hierarchy heaven, like many of them are. And so they're really very terribly evangelistic. But, of course, that is never a measure of truth. Are there any other questions? Mike?